You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome everyone to Trek FM's Ready Room podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today here is Greg Harbin. And today we're going to talk about some Star Trek news, and we're going to talk about Enterprise and the Zendikar. How are you doing today, Greg?
I'm doing great, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's nice and cool here.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully. It's beautiful. Turned into a nice sunny day up here.
Oh, great. Well, let's see. So let's just jump right into some Star Trek news here. The big topic, of course, is the next movie and some rumors of a possible delay.
Yeah. Of course, nothing new delays with Star Trek films. The first one was supposed to come out Christmas of, was it 2008?
Yeah,
and then got bumped to summer the next year.
That's right, and probably for the better, I think.
I don't know.
I don't like these movies being rushed out personally.
No.
So let's talk about first of all the release schedule was supposed to be June 29th of 2012, and shooting was supposed to start in September. Of this year, and
right.
It seems like that might get pushed out to the holidays.
Yep, that's what it seems like. I believe you can get the news on this better than me, but Bob Orkey, I believe, said that there's a treatment that they're ready to get input from JJ about. So that's obviously no finished script as of yet.
Oh, well, a treatment. That sounds nice, since I think Orkey's target date was late March for getting a sign-off on the script. Right.
Right.
So we've got a treatment here at the end of May, and hopefully some input coming from JJ soon. All right.
Yeah, there seems to be a delay. I mean, what's JJ doing right now? Obviously, he's the one in control of Star Trek at the moment.
Well, I think this is what I read in some coverage from Trek Movie. com and also just seeing some other promos going around as I do some entertainment things. Super 8 is
right
kind of in the works, and it seems like maybe his attention is very much on Super 8 right now.
Yeah, Super 8. And also I believe this fall Alcatraz is going to be on Fox, which is a new show he's producing with Jorge Garcia and some other people.
All right.
So that might be taking some of his time as well.
I think he's stretched a little thin.
And how could I forget Mission Impossible 4?
Oh, great.
Which he's producing, although Brad Bird is directing. So, yeah, this guy is he must be the most busy guy, you know, doing genre stuff that we'd be interested in.
So the plot of Mission Impossible 4 is to get Star Trek 2 out by June 29th, 2012, right?
There we go. I think we'd need Tom Cruise to do some aerobics for that one.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, so you said you've heard there's a treatment waiting for input.
Right.
And I had heard that they're kind of working off of a 70-page outline. So
yeah.
I guess that's the treatment that we're talking about
yeah.
here. Well, I mean, how do you feel about if the movie's pushed out to the holidays? Because, you know, traditionally, a lot of the Star Trek movies have had holiday releases.
Right.
I remember, you know, going to so many of them. Over the years with the original cast around the holidays.
Oh, certainly. I mean, I remember the first movie I remember seeing was Star Trek VI, which I saw with my family. And that was, I believe, a holiday release.
That was a holiday release.
And it's a big thing. But if you look at Star Trek Nemesis, it came out in Christmas time-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And there were just a couple other big films. I think there was a Harry Potter film. There was a Lord of the Rings film. And no one paid attention to Nemesis.
Yeah. Well, you know, a Harry Potter film and a Lord of the Rings film, those are each worth, you know, five usual big releases, I
exactly.
think.
Exactly. Right.
So, but I don't think that's, you know, exclusively what killed Nemesis.
Well, sure. But I think it helps for people to think of Star Trek as being one of these big, big summer blockbusters.
Hmm.
So I really don't want it seeing it come out at Christmas, honestly. I was quite happy when the last one was moved to the summer, because I think people are just ready to see a big action movie like this.
Yeah. Well, so you think this is going to be another big action movie, or do you think they're going to get a little more talky in this, like the original cast movies were.
This is sort of what they did. They'd have a big action one and then sort of have a cerebral one, and they have a big action one and then a cerebral one. And then, but I don't know. It seems to me JJ has a specific vision for this, that it just needs to have a good helping of both. You know, have some action, have some heart. I would like to see a little bit more brain being used in the next one,
Yeah.
but.
Well, do you think in the first one, okay, so this is what I hear, from some fans about the first one, is that it's a good movie, but as a Star Trek movie, and there's a lot of introducing the characters, basically. The
Right,
first movie's introducing the characters. And I guess in a way you have to do that because they are going after a new audience. There are those of us who've been watching Star Trek for decades, and then there's, but we're getting older and they're wanting to go after another audience as well. So they have to kind of introduce the characters, and we did find some interesting little tidbits they threw in there. I liked when McCoy told Kirk that all he has left are his
Oh, that's
bones,
great.
and finally, here's why Kirk calls McCoy
Right.
bones, even if it is in an alternate timeline.
That was a great moment.
But the movie for me, it felt like I really enjoyed the movie. I felt like the story itself, though, was maybe a little bit simplistic. For a Star Trek film, but I kind of dismissed that because I knew that they're trying to introduce the characters and they're trying to establish how everyone met in this new timeline. But for the next movie, I really am hoping to see something that's a little more substantial.
So I guess this would be a good time for me to talk about the idea I had for the sequel right after the
Okay.
first one came out. I really wanted to see, let's see, just a basic outline was that there was going to be some Vulcans who were angry at the Federation for allowing basically their planet to be destroyed. And they would be angry at the Federation and angry at the Romulans. And sort of set up a kind of Maquis splinter group that was going to go after Romulus. And so then all of our people would have to go after them and, stop them. Which I think would give us a good chance to explore Vulcans and explore this revenge, which revenge has always been a really strong theme in Star Trek. And I think it'd be good to explore some of those deeper themes about, what you do when your culture is really destroyed, like happened to Vulcan. I really hope they don't just gloss over it or jump forward 10 years or something.
Like it never happened, and then
Exactly.
suddenly, oh, there's Vulcan. It'll be like in So Long and Thanks for All the Fish when there's another Earth.
It's
How'd
just
it get there? I don't
isn't
know. There's
on.
another Vulcan, but Spock's feet don't touch the ground. I don't know. So
Or even
vague references there for all you science fiction fans.
I mean, even Star Trek VI didn't really deal with the effects on Kronos that, like, I feel it really should have.
Yeah.
And we know it brought the Klingons like into the Federation and all that, but we never actually got to see it
Well,
dealt
not
with.
into the Federation, but
Well, it,
the warmer relationship
warmer
with the Federation.
relationship, yes.
Yeah.
Obviously not into but
Right.
there are Vulcan, there are Klingons finally serving on ships once we get to next gen. So, but I'd like to see, how that actually happens, like how you deal with your planet being destroyed.
I think it's an interesting idea. I think it's very much Star Trek. It would be a great story for a Star Trek film. What are your thoughts on the box office if they did something like that?
I kind of feel like they've got a free pass on the next one. As strange as it seems, the first one did so well that I think people will just go see the next one. If it, but if it's not good, there might not be another one after that. I'm trying to think of another time when this happened, when one movie, it may have been Spider-Man, that the first one was so good that it didn't matter what the second one was. People were just going to flock to it. And then the third one, people just flocked to it. And then the third one actually wasn't good. So even though it made loads of money, they couldn't make a fourth one.
So that's what I call the free Willy effect.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
yeah, this will be a pretty big film.
What'll be
What do you think?
Well, I'd like to see them do that. My favorite Star Trek films and episodes are the ones that follow that path where you take a much deeper
Right.
More philosophical approach to things. I don't know how it'll do. Well, like you said, I think for this one at the box office, yeah, they'd probably be safe. I think people are going to go out and see this one because it's the last JJ film. I know some longtime Star Trek fans aren't real fond of it, but
yeah.
But overall, you know, it was a huge film. It was right. by far the biggest Star Trek film at the box office,
right.
even adjusting for inflation.
Yeah.
And so I think there will be a big turnout for it. I guess maybe it's not the philosophical kind of deep side that they have to worry about. Maybe it's taking the philosophical side and getting a little like too inside Star Trek.
Right.
That would alienate the general audience.
That's true.
You know, because if you look at in the Next Generation films, if you look at Insurrection.
I was just going to talk about that, so please jump
in. Insurrection, I think, was actually quite a good movie.
Mm.
Well, I should say it was quite a good story.
Okay, yeah.
But it was basically a long Star Trek The Next Generation TV episode.
Yes.
With a bigger budget than what they could do on TV. You know, it was really Star Trek. It had a good message where they explored some things, but after First Contact, it just felt like, from a moviegoer standpoint, I think it
right.
really felt like a letdown.
Right.
And there was just too much of it that relied on you knowing Star Trek.
Yes.
Whereas First Contact, you didn't need to know Star Trek to enjoy First Contact. It was
yeah.
just a good action movie.
Yeah, I mean, with First Contact, they had such this strong premise of, I mean, Ronald Moore and Brendan Braga sort of said, let's do Ahab. Let's do Moby Dick and let's send Picard down this path of going after the Borg for revenge. And that's something everyone could understand. Even the whole movie actually wasn't as action-packed as you might think. There was a lot of...
That's true, yeah. There were a lot of slower moments in there.
Yeah. But even so, it had this strong pushing motion that everyone could understand, whereas Insurrection was much more about, you know, the perils of utopia, which I find interesting. I find interesting seeing, you know, what happens to the Federation. But I think I find that interesting because I'm sort of sold on the Star Trek premise. And
yeah.
I've been growing up with this, and I want to know, well, what's going to happen to the Federation? You know, I actually care if they lose their moral standing.
Yeah.
Whereas your average everyday, you know, Lord of the Rings viewer doesn't care as much about
right.
what happens to the Federation.
Yeah, because you know the background. I mean, you know what the Federation was. You know how it has evolved
exactly.
over the various series. And you kind of had to know that going into Insurrection.
Yeah.
I mean, you see a corrupt Federation. But if you're not a Star Trek fan and you go in and you see that, well, you don't know that the Federation isn't always like that. So it does lose some of the impact.
And that's what you expect from a film. You know, you look at Star Wars, you look at Pirates of the Caribbean. You sort of have this corrupt governing force. You know, that's what you expect. You expect our hero to go against whoever's in control. It's really strange that Star Trek, it's odd that it's a strange thing, I guess.
Uh-huh. Well, let's
yes.
talk about one other aspect of this next movie then, that's a bit of controversial as well.
Mm.
And that is that JJ has come out and said that he's under a lot of pressure from the studio to go 3D on
yeah.
it. So what do you think about that?
Yeah,
I am
3D.
Really mixed on 3D myself, but I'm curious what you think about it.
Yeah, 3D is an interesting thing. I've only seen a couple movies in 3D, which, you know, I was blown away by Avatar because, you know, James Cameron went into it thinking, I'm going to make it in 3D. I want to do this certain thing. I want to frame everything just right for 3D. And so he made exactly the movie he wanted to make in 3D. And if JJ was coming to it saying, you know, I really want to make it in 3D, I could possibly get behind it. But if it's the studio pressuring him, I don't know. I don't like it to be something forced on the movie with this.
Yeah, that's
yeah. Mm-hmm. This new Thor, yeah, Thor that Kenneth Branagh directed. The studio basically told him, we're going to convert it to 3D and you're not going to have any input and, you know, make the film you want to make and then it's going to be 3D. And from what I understand, the 3D isn't interesting, doesn't add anything to the movie, and isn't terribly well done. The other thing is conversion versus shooting in 3D. Avatar was actually shot in 3D, as was, I just saw the new Pirates of the Caribbean movie, which is also actually shot in 3D, and it makes a big difference when the director is there saying, you know, he actually can see it in 3D on his screen and makes it look right. Whereas when someone, actually I have some friends of mine who are in this business, they come in later and add the 3D, you know, they're just trying to get it done. You know, they have this 9-to-5 job. They're just trying to paint stuff and put it on different layers and just make it look dimensional. But it doesn't have the same immersion that it has when you actually shoot in 3D.
Yeah.
But shooting in 3D takes a lot of dedication. Yeah. And I don't know that JJ wants to do that.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like he really wants to do it. And I think his concern, just, I mean, I'm speculating, of course, because I, you know, I haven't talked to him this week or anything, but I think his concern is probably my concern about 3D too, is that, well, you know, I've grew up with the old 3D stuff with the, you know, you got the blue and the red glasses and everything is 3D and it sucks and it's gimmicky, you know?
Right.
So, and so I'm skeptical about 3D to start with. Now,
yeah.
I've only been to the theater to see one 3D movie, which was Alice in Wonderland.
Alice.
And, you know, I thought it was pretty well done, but the reason for me is that what I don't like, and this comes, I guess, from me being a designer, I don't like anything that's forced. So,
right. Yeah.
And my concern with, there are a lot of 3D movies. What was the one that was put out? And I know even, I think Blu-ray manufacturers were complaining about this last year. It was like Piranha 3D.
Piranha 3D?
Something like that. You know, and they're saying, this is just, you know, it's just crap. And it gives a bad impression of the 3D televisions that we're trying to sell because, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, James Cameron came out like virulently against Piranha 3D saying it
Yeah, it's like people say.
Kills it.
Or the manufacturers say, look, the public already thinks this 3D stuff is a gimmick and fad anyway to try to sell more televisions. And then you put stuff like this out and all it does is reinforce that feeling that 3D is a gimmick. So.
Yeah.
I don't want to see a Star Trek where someone is turning a phaser and shooting it out at the audience because the movie's in 3D. No, I don't want to see that.
Well, I was really impressed by this Pirates movie. You know, the first three were in 2D, and then this one was in 3D, and I felt like they were. It didn't feel jarring. It didn't feel forced.
If it adds depth to if it gives you that feeling that you're more in the environment.
Right. That's
what
I'm all
for it. Yeah.
I am concerned. We didn't talk about, you know, whether or not JJ is going to direct. If he does, direct, I'm not sure that his filming style would transfer to 3D. He does a lot of quick edits. He has very cluttered frames and I'm not sure. I think it could get a little nauseating.
Do you hope he directs, or are you hoping for someone else to direct?
Well,
regardless of 3D, just generally speaking as a Star Trek movie.
I like the idea of having new directors. Harry Potter did a really great thing of having a different director for every movie, except I think the first two and the last few. Mm-hmm. Just trying to get a new director in and get some new blood. I think Nimoy directing... I mean, did he only direct two? And then Shatner directed one of the old ones.
Nimoy, yeah, he did three and four, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I felt like Nimoy did a pretty good job on three, and then four felt kind of just let's get this done.
You don't really like four so much.
I don't. We should talk about four sometime. I don't
we'll
really
talk
like
about
four.
That some other time. Okay.
I would have liked to see some new people come in, but then Nicholas Meyer directed, I believe, two and six.
He did two and six. Yeah.
And I love both of those. I think he really so. And I sort of compare the new one to Wrath of Khan, And if you can do the same thing of bring new life to it, like Nicholas Meyer did for Six, then that'll be great. But I do hope he eventually passes it on.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to see him direct this next one, because I think that because the first one was just so much character introduction.
Right.
I think we kind of need that consistency.
Right. Right.
In the second one to get things established. And then maybe they bring in somebody else. Yeah. You know, hopefully for the third one, it's not going to be Stuart Baird.
Right. Stuart Baird.
But, but yeah, maybe they bring in some other blood there too.
Did Frakes refuse to direct Nemesis, or
I don't
what
think
happened
so.
There?
I think I could be wrong on this. Just my recollection is that the studio wanted to go a different route on it. So, you know, they brought in new blood for writing and directing both. I don't think Frakes was offered Nemesis.
That's strange.
And in fact, you know, it could be that because he directed Insurrection, right?
Mm-hmm.
It could be because Insurrection kind of flopped at the box office that they wanted to go in a new direction, you know, not wanting to look at themselves and realize that it wasn't Frakes' direction that was the problem with Insurrection.
Yeah, I don't think Berman knew what was wrong with Star Trek. I don't think he ever quite figured it out. We probably should at some point talk about his interviews at StarTrek.com. I'm not quite sure if Berman ever quite figured it out. And obviously we've moved on from the Berman era.
Well, one thing that I do think that he has right, that he has said a number of times about what went wrong with Star Trek, is that the studio went to the well too many times.
Yeah.
Too quickly.
Yeah.
I kind of agree. You know, I think they got a little bit greedy. I think that Enterprise was, which we'll talk about in a little bit. I think Enterprise was an example of them maybe trying to push too much.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we needed a couple of years break after Voyager.
I think
instead
a couple
of going
years
right
really
into
good.
A new series like that. So, okay. Well, before we stop talking about the movie, it's turning into the all JJ show.
It is.
The one thing I really want to get your thoughts on are the possible villains in the next movie. Because there's been a number of villains.
Yeah, obviously,
kicked around
right after the movie came out. Everyone was talking about Khan. You know, are they going to recast Khan?
Of course. Yeah.
And so my continuing in my script idea that I had back in fall of that year was that they would come across the Botany Bay. They'd come across the Botany Bay. Before chronologically earlier than they were supposed to, and. You know, they'd bring Khan actually aboard the Enterprise, and he would join them in this struggle, and eventually take over the Enterprise, and that would be sort of the big climax. Is they're trying to get to Romulus to protect them, but Khan actually has control of the ship. But since then, I've started to think, you know, maybe we shouldn't be relying on the old stuff, because as you say, you know, we have new people watching Star Trek now. We don't want everyone to have to have seen these old shows, even the old movies, to understand what's going on. So why don't you talk about what's being rumored now?
Well, I think, of course, the Khan was the first thing everyone talked about. And my first reaction to it was, oh, please don't do Khan.
Really?
And it's not that I don't like Khan. I love Khan. And, you know, and I still think Wrath of Khan is probably the best of all the Star Trek movies. It's certainly up there in, you know, the top two or three. Without a doubt. The reason I kind of anti-Khan on this is that I don't want to just see them hit the reset button and go through Star Trek again with a different cast. You know, just because they encountered Khan in Star Trek II doesn't mean that they have to encounter Khan in this Star Trek II, because then what's going to happen, you know, is... Are they going to go look for Spock in the third JJ movie? And are they going to have to go get a whale in the fourth JJ movie? You know, it's going to be like an orca instead of a back, you know, I mean, what's it going to be? I just don't want to
see your point there.
That,
yeah.
You know? And, so, now if they encounter Khan at some point in the future, you know, that's fine. But, you know, honestly, if it were me as a creative, I would just stay away from the con stuff altogether. Now, if they were doing a TV series, it might be different. Yeah, maybe they encounter con. But when you're going to do a movie every 3 years, I think you have to really pick and choose what you're going to do. Well, you don't get a lot of chances.
Do you want to see what we've sort of seen from the best Star Trek movies is a strong, like another captain who's very strong. Like we had Khan or we had General Chang.
Yeah.
One of these nemeses, not to bring up the memories of Star Trek Nemesis, but a nemesis for the captain.
There we had another Picard.
We actually had
younger.
Another. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think the movie needs that. I think that's what's, if you look at the weaker Star Trek movies, that's what you've been missing. You know, you, Insurrection really didn't have a strong, foe.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what, Generations, I mean, Sorin was, you know, there are moments in that movie I really like that character. I like this kind of obsession with time thing that's going on, but he wasn't a worthy, you know, he wasn't like a Khan like.
I think what's interesting about Sorin and Cybok is that these people aren't captains.
Yeah.
They're just guys.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's
guys.
It's not as interesting for the captain to fight a guy.
Yeah. Star Trek 2 guys. So, yeah, I think it needs that. So, well, here's what's being kicked around. Okay, of course, there was a con thing, but I haven't really heard. I really don't think the con thing is in play. I think that was fans saying con. What I have been hearing in rumors, of course, the biggest one is Harry Mudd,
right?
With Jack Black, which
Jesus.
It's going to be really hard for me if they were to cast Jack Black as Harry Mudd. You know, I think Jack Black is perfect for the character, but I just don't like Jack Black. And if I had to watch Jack, it's kind of like before Enterprise was set, and everyone was speculating, what are they going to do after Voyager?
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of fans that wanted an Excelsior series with George Takei. You know, okay, I like, as George Takei has gotten older, you know, he's entertaining. I like George Takei, but as an actor, I could not watch 7 seasons of George Takei as the lead.
He's
I'm sorry, George. I'm sorry. I love you, but
he's a great guy. I love when he shows up. I love when he showed up on Voyager.
Yeah.
I even liked the fan film he was in.
Yeah.
But for every season, you know, watching him episode after episode, trying to carry it, I can't see it happening.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, same here. So it would have been really hard for me to watch a series like that. And the same for here with the movie. If Jack Black is in this movie, it's going to be really hard for me to watch it more than once.
Yeah.
So.
And we don't really need to go in a comedic direction, I don't think.
The other thing about Mudd, I mean, you can't play Mudd as a life and death struggle with Kirk and his crew, you know? I mean, Mudd is a comedic character, which is why Jack Black would be perfect for it, besides the fact that he actually looks kind of like the
does.
Original Harry
that
Mudd.
Would totally work. If they were doing a TV show reboot, I'd love to see them do a Mudd episode. I wouldn't have to go back and watch it. It would just be there.
Yeah, you know, that would be great.
I went back, I watched Mudd's Women recently. I was like, okay, that was fun.
That was fine, yeah.
But is it, for a movie, we need somebody strong.
So then we can move over to another rumored one is Trelane.
Now you're gonna have to remind me. Is that the one that is sort of like a Q figure?
Yeah, Trelane is the Squire of Gothos.
Okay.
In the original series, of course, there was no Q, but later on, it has kind of there's been this connection made that maybe Trelane was a Q.
Okay.
It's never been made on the TV show, but in the novels, Greg Cox wrote a series of novels called Q Continuum.
Yes.
And Q Space was one of the novels, and Q Space focused on Trelane as a Q. And Picard and Q, John Delancey's Q, maybe we should call him Q Prime,
there we go.
had to prevent the... I think it was actually the destruction of the universe or something bold like that. It's been years since I read that novel.
Right.
from happening because of Trelane. So Trelane was kind of pulled in to the as a queue later on down the road.
I see.
If they did Trelane in this next movie, I think there's a good chance they might play that queue angle now that queue are so established.
I think a queue could be an interesting element. I did want to ask, that is, Trelane is a character played by the now late Bill Campbell. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, so yep. I wanted to mention that he has passed recently.
That's right. He passed away just a few weeks ago, wasn't it? 3-4 weeks ago.
That's right. Okay, so anyway, I could see it interesting to do a Q angle on it. There were possibly too many Q episodes of Voyager.
Yeah.
But as a once-a-season thing, or maybe one of the movies, we haven't done a Q movie, it could be interesting to do one of those super powerful, you know, he's sort of in control, trickster villains. I don't think it's been done in any of the movies, although it's been done in a couple of the shows.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's been done in the movies. I wonder how. Okay, so for a new audience, well, okay, first of all, if they did Trelane, I think that they have to play the Q angle,
right,
to make it work. I don't think that you could play Squire of Gothos again and make that work as a film.
Right.
But if they played the Q angle, yeah, I mean, it actually could be a good movie. Yeah. And I think for a new audience, it would work fine.
Mm-hmm.
What I wonder about is how the old Star Trek audience would accept the idea of a Q that wasn't John DeLancey as the feature character.
That's,
as a Q.
That is true. That is true. We have had several Qs. Over the course of the show, wow! I do not have all these actors' names in front of me, but the woman who played Susie Plaxson,
who played
there we go, that was Kessler,
Q,
right?
And Voyager, Q's wife,
right? And then
and
John DeLancey's son played played their son, and there's another guy who played some random Q who wanted to commit suicide.
Yeah, that was Death Wish on Voyager,
right.
And I can't remember the actor's name off the top of my head.
Yeah,
but
not
coming
to me either. So we've had some different cues. I should say, I do not want to see John DeLancey show up in a J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie.
No, I don't think you can do that across the timelines like that, no.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think fans could deal with a Trelane story and a Q story that didn't involve him.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I hadn't really thought that deeply into it on the Q angle until now. So now that we talk about that, actually, I'd be open to Trelane in the next movie. Well, another one is Gary Mitchell.
Right.
From Where No Man Has Gone Before, with the silver sparkles in his eyes. And I'm not sure how you make a movie out of this with a villain.
Well, it's been done. There was the... Which one was it? Of Gods and Men was the Star Trek fan film that Tim
That's
Russ...
That's the Phase 2 film, right?
Was it a Phase 2
well,
film?
Well, they're called Phase 2 now.
Okay.
They were like New Voyages, I think, when they released that one.
I believe...
It's the fan film.
I'm trying to think. This is actually, I think, a different project from that one.
Oh, it was
one.
A different one. Okay.
This is the one that's direct... This was directed by Tim Russ.
Okay.
And they got a few of the original actors, and then... Basically, everyone in the movie was an actual Star Trek actor.
Well, Nichelle Nichols was in that one.
Nichelle Nichols was in it. Walter Koenig? I always forget how to pronounce that one.
I think it's Koenig. But
Koenig. Walter Koenig
yeah,
was in it.
Yeah.
The guy who played Saval in Enterprise was on it. And anyway, the villain was actually Gary Mitchell. And it ended up... It was Gary Mitchell versus Charlie X... ended up being the big, like, supernatural battle at the end.
Okay.
And I don't know. That movie was a letdown to me. I think it took the powers a little too far. I don't know that I want to see someone with sparkles in their eyes powers.
Yeah, I don't know either. I'm just looking here, just to correct ourselves here.
Please do.
It was not Phase 2, you're right. It was Renegade Studios.
There we go.
And Great Bird of the Galaxy Productions.
Right.
Are the people who made Star Trek of Gods and Men.
And directed by Tim Russ, who played...
Yep. Tim Russ in there, Tuvok. Walter Koenig, Nichelle Nichols, and is it John Harriman who played... captain of the Enterprise B. Is that right?
That's right, John Harriman, who was in Generations or Star Trek VI?
He was in, it's the beginning of Generations.
Okay, Generations.
Captain of the Enterprise B, the captain who just kind of crumbled at the first moment that he was needed to actually make a decision on anything, which was obviously dying to play up Kirk, but
right.
And actually, always left me thinking, how did this guy get to be captain of the flagship of the Federation? You know.
Well, if you're,
although
if you're
I loved
ever
him
wondering,
on Spin City.
He was great on Spin City. He was actually the best part of this fan film. Alan Ruck is a great actor.
Alan Ruck, yep. Harriman was the actual captain's name. Right.
Yeah, right.
Alan Harriman. Ruck, yes.
And
yes,
he completely redeems the character in this movie. He has a great heroic arc and saves the day and sacrifices himself. Spoiler alert. And,
well, I've got to go watch that. I actually have only seen the teaser of this. I haven't watched the whole thing, so I got to go do that.
So it's worth watching, actually, for him. I wouldn't mind seeing him show up in one of the J.J. Abrams films, actually.
Oh, interesting.
Quite an interesting character.
All right. But, so it could, they might could pull it off, but, you know, I'd have to say, especially since these guys have already done it.
Right.
And if God's a man, I would prefer not to see Gary Mitchell going in. Another one is Alien Foe, the Talosians from
right.
The Cage.
So what do you think about using the Talosians?
Yeah, I don't know. I think you could make a movie out of it, especially because we still have Pike right now. I think it could work, but you know, we're talking about needing a strong villain, a strong foe, and having a collective other than the Borg, and even in the Borg, even in First Contact, we had the Queen. We didn't just have the Borg.
Came up with the concept of the Queen for that reason. Yeah.
So I think we'd have to have like a Talosian Queen or something like that.
I don't know. I think we need to bow to the wisdom of the CBS executives from 1964 and
skip that.
And say that maybe we need a more action adventure oriented villain.
Yeah, I think so too. And
not that I
and
think
so
we need to
means...
have a salt vampire in the
a salt vampire, okay. and great marketing tie in there, you know, with the popcorn and so the I guess that leads us to the last one that I've heard kicked around as being a no go, which is the Horta.
Oh, God. That's got to just be a joke, right?
It's got to be. I mean, I don't know how you have a pile of molten lava as the villain of your movie and hope to make, you know, $300 million at the box office out of it. So
no.
I don't think we really need to talk much about the Horta other than I have to say I really don't want to see that.
No. I think what they have to do is come up with a new villain. Mm. And I'm not sure who it's going to be, but I think they should have their own ship. I think they need to be a captain. I think that was one good thing about Nero is that he had his own ship and he had people following him and he could go up against Kirk and be a force to be reckoned with. One thing I would like to see is, if you look at Wrath of Khan, I guess not Star Trek VI, but look at Wrath of Khan, Khan and Kirk never actually meet on film.
That's true.
I'd like to see an enemy that Kirk can actually fight. And I don't know, does it have to be hand to hand or something? But I'd like to see a real confrontation between equals in this next one.
Yeah, I think that the movie audience may expect that too.
Yeah.
So that could be very well be a possibility, which of course means that the Trelane angle might not work for that because you're not going to have, if Trelane is played as a Q, you're not going to have, you know, the only time we've ever seen a hand to hand with the Q is when Sisko punched Q out on Deep Space Nine,
which
was great. And then Picard never punched me.
Exactly. That was great.
Not
great
Picard. You know? Now, before we get into our discussion of Enterprise, there are just a few things that I want to share with you, and the first is to ask you, how high is your Star Trek IQ? We've teamed up with Trek Trivia, which is run by Mark Stamper and Anthony Davis on Twitter. They do live quizzes several times each week, and we now have a new page on the Trek FM website for Trek Trivia, and we have a multiple choice quiz that changes each week. There are 12 questions, and if you can answer them all, you win an exclusive Trek FM Trek Trivia badge. And this is suitable for use as a Twitter avatar or a decoration for your blog. And come back each week and try your hand again. And you can find that page on our site at trek.fm/trektrivia. And you can follow Mark and Anthony on Twitter at trektrivia, twitter.com/trektrivia, and find out the game schedule. It's usually two or three times a week. They have live sessions. Okay, and another thing that I wanted to mention is our newsletter. Trek FM is launching a new newsletter. We actually launched the first issue this week on Monday. And it's a recap of news, feature stories, updates on our podcasts, and we also have some exclusives for newsletter subscribers. In the first issue, we have exclusive Klingon wallpaper. It's available only to newsletter subscribers. So please visit trek.fm/subscribe to add your name to the mailing list. We have a double opt-in process. We don't spam. You need to sign up. You need to click a link in your email to verify that you want the newsletter, and then you'll be set to go. And in addition to those items in the newsletter, we also have the results of our weekly polls. The first poll was the favorite series poll. And our current poll is what Greg and I were just discussing, the villain that you want to see in the next Star Trek film. Okay, one more item here before we get into our Enterprise discussion. Coming up on June 11th in the city of Industry, California, Frank and Son Collectibles is hosting their Star Trek Sci-Fi Day. Of course, there's going to be lots of collectibles there, other events for Star Trek fans to do, and there are quite a few actors and actresses from the Star Trek series who are going to be there to sign autographs and talk to fans. Now, to tell you more about this event, Trek FM feature writer Lisa M. Lynch has an interview with Frank and Son, and let's play that for you right now.
This is George Cordero. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
You did. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you? So this
not
is
bad, not bad.
Excellent. You're holding the Sci-Fi Fan Day, Saturday, June 11th.
Yes, at the Frank and Son Collectible Show here in Industry, California, we're going to be hosting what we're effectively called second annual Star Trek Sci-Fi Fan Day. This is the first time. The first one that we did was really more of just an autograph signing. We had Ethan Phillips, Tim Rush, Robert Picardo, and a lot of the classic characters from some of the original series episodes. But this time around, we're actually putting on a full-on event because we've actually expanded the collectible show. We have a 10,000 square foot exhibit area, and so we're actually utilizing that. My idea was to build a bigger event and not just an autograph signing.
So this, what is the Frank and Son Collectible? Can you tell me a little bit about your business?
Oh, yeah. Frank and Son Collectible Show, it's basically, think of it like a Comic-Con without all of the, you know, the Hollywood studios there. It's effectively a 65,000 square foot warehouse that is populated with about 300 dealers right now. And those dealers sell everything from comic books to movie memorabilia, sports memorabilia, Magic the Gathering, trading cards, video games, current and classic, toys, action figures, Hot Toys collectibles, Happy Meal collectibles. I mean, you name it, it's all there. Movies, DVDs, Blu-rays. I mean, anything that people collect or that's you know, a pop culture staple, it's at the show. The show's been running for over 20 years. It originally started at the Frank and Son Trucking Warehouse with only 5,000 square feet, and it's grown in 20 years to 65,000 square feet with the additional 10,000 square feet we've added for the exhibition area.
Wow, that just sounds fantastic. And what actors? I assume you've got a lot of big names coming this Saturday, on the 11th, I'm sorry, June 11th.
Oh, absolutely. We've got Marina Sirtis, who played Counselor Deanna Troi in Star Trek The Next Generation and Voyager and in the series finale of Enterprise. Mm-hmm. We've got Tucker Smallwood, who played the Zindi Primate Counselor in the Zindi story arc of Star Trek Enterprise, and he also played Admiral Bullock on Star Trek Voyager when they had the incident with Species 8427. Mm-hmm. We have Tim Russ coming, who played Lieutenant Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager. Anthony Vitale, who played the Shipyard Welder in the 2009 Star Trek teaser for the J.J. Abrams movie. And he's really rare. He doesn't really do conventions. I think he's only done one other show ever. We have John Delancey coming, who plays Q on Star Trek Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager. We have Robert Picardo coming, who is the EMH on Star Trek Voyager. Here we have Richard Hurd, who played Admiral Paris, Tom Paris's father, on Star Trek Voyager. And then I don't have the notes here, but I believe he also played one of the Klingons on Star Trek Next Generation. We have Larry Hankin coming, who played Gaunt Gary in Star Trek Voyager. It was one of Tom Paris's holodeck programs that had the pool hall player. He was essentially the pool shark. We have Chase Masterson coming, Lisa from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Carl Stroykin, who was Mr. Hom on Star Trek Next Generation, who is Lakshwana Troy's kind of a manservant, if you will. And then we have Kate Vernon, who was Commander Valerie Archer on the Star Trek Voyager Species 8427 episode.
Wow.
She was the one that Chakotay showed a love interest in, that then he found out, like, oh, dude, you're an alien, but you're so hot. He was conflicted. He didn't know what to do.
Most aliens are pretty hot, right?
They, so, you know, if we believe anything that sci-fi has shown us, yes, yes, they
yes.
are.
Yeah, I've got my own thing.
I'm sorry, actually, one person we do have coming is actually not Trek-related, but they are part of the Roddenberry family. It's actually Kevin Sorbo, who played Captain Dylan Hunt on Andromeda, and he's
Andromeda.
Also, I mean, most famously known for being Hercules from Hercules, The Legendary Journey.
The stars are going to be signing autographs?
Yes, they'll be signing autographs, taking pictures, and then we're also going to have a oversized Playmates action figure card from Star Trek The Next Generation printed up that you can actually take a picture in front of it like you're an action figure.
Oh, neat. Well, that's fantastic. You've got other things, too. You've got Star Trek makeup sessions, Star Trek online gaming stations.
Well, we had some great people come on board to help support the show, one of them being the Cinema Makeup School of Los Angeles. They're going to be on hand, and they're going to be doing Star Trek and sci-fi makeup effects on attendees, and they'll be doing that free of charge. There's going to be live PC gaming stations running Cryptic Studios' Star Trek Online video game, and those will be run by Mr. Fixer Computer Repair, and Cryptic has actually donated several trial keys for Star Trek Online that we're going to be able to give away to attendees. And you'll actually be able to come and play the game at the event and try it out and see how it is. And then you get a free trial key so you can go home and play it. We're going to have free Star Trek collector cards being given away by Mark's Non-Sports Cards. They've generously donated several of them. And he has several different sci-fi and Star Trek cards you're going to be able to purchase from him as well, including pieces that have been autographed. And a little tidbit is actually he was one of the prop guys that built several of the props and sets on all of the different Star Trek series except for the original series. War Machine Marketing will be there, and they'll actually have a booth displaying how you can have a action figure of yourself made that's fully articulated that you can actually play with for a nominal fee, of course, but you can have your own Starfleet character made of yourself. You know, I mean, that's pretty cool.
That's what I want.
And, yeah. And then we'll actually have... I haven't announced it yet. I'll go ahead and I'm going to give you the exclusive. It's we're going to have goodie bags made up for attendees. So the first 100 people through the door are actually going to get a goodie bag that's going to have some free toys in it, a lot of Star Trek toys and then a lot of sci-fi related toys. And those are generously donated by the Frankenstein Collectible Show and also by UCC Distribution, which is one of the dealers at the show. In addition to that, there will be exclusive event T-shirts made. We're having red shirts made. If you're a Trekkie, you know what that means. And those will be limited, but attendees will be receiving those. There'll be a set amount for the first few people that come through the door, and then they'll be given out throughout the day. And it's going to go well because we actually have the Klingon Assault Group is going to be coming down in full costume. So you're going to be wearing a red shirt. It's going to be Klingons walking around. Several photo opportunities that day.
You got red shirts and Klingons.
Yes, yes.
Oh, that sounds like it's going to be just so much fun. And this will be on Saturday, June 11th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. in City of Industry, California.
Yeah, if any of your listeners want to get more details on the events, they can actually just go to our website, which is frankandsonshow.com, and you can see all the details under the special events section. And you can also find us on Facebook, and you can look for the event on Facebook as well. We're also on Twitter, @FrankandSonShow.
Well, thank you so much for your time, George.
No, thank you. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I hope you have a wonderful show and have a good day today.
All right. Thank you so much.
This is Lisa M. Lynch with Frank and Sons' George Cadero. Now, let's move into our discussion of Enterprise. Talking about bringing in new villains, because we do need fresh blood on Star Trek from time to time. And with Enterprise, they kind of went to a new direction.
They
and,
did. Yeah, so I've
and
been...
brought in some new villains. So why don't we take a look at Enterprise?
Yeah. So I've been rewatching some Star Trek recently. I've rewatched the entire run of Voyager and then said, why don't I get back into Enterprise? Because I had some pretty negative memories of Enterprise, as I think a lot of Trek fans do, especially ones who haven't revisited the show. Thought of it as being, you know, maybe the worst show. Not worth thinking about a weird offshoot with that guy from Quantum Leap.
That guy from Quantum Leap, yeah.
But I've actually been quite impressed with the show, especially the first season. I thought it actually did the Strange New Worlds concept. They actually had an episode called Strange New World where there was no villain but the world. It was it was poisoning the crew and making them think that strange things were going on. Actually, I want to hear your thoughts about it, and then maybe I can jump in. What did you think of the first couple seasons?
Well, okay, so my... First of all, I was following the developments about the series, what was going to come after Voyager. I was like really following it pretty seriously. And I, you know, have seen all the series from the newer series. I've seen them all from their premieres and watched them in first run. So by the time we got to the end of Voyager, I was like, okay, this is really interesting. What are they going to do? Because I kind of was feeling like the 24th century was getting played out a little bit too much.
Yes.
And I thought that they needed to find some way to inject some new blood into Star Trek, or else the franchise was gonna teeter out.
So you didn't want Rikers in space?
No, not at the time.
Okay.
But you know, now I actually think that Titan would make a really good series, which we can talk about some other time.
Probably some other time.
Yeah, but I think that actually has potential for a series, and I think they could return to the 24th century now and be successful. But but at the time, you know, when Voyager was winding down, I thought, well, you know, if they're just going to do another another series that's contemporary to TNG and DS9 and Voyager, how much of an audience is there for this, and what kind of stories are they going to tell?
Right.
And so There were several ideas being kicked around at the time, and I actually looked back recently. I used to write a column way back then. I used to write a column about Star Trek and science fiction and social issues and so forth.
Oh, okay.
And I went back and I looked at some old things that I had written from back then, and I wrote a few things about the direction of Star Trek. And one of the ideas being kicked around was, of course, the Excelsior series, which we mentioned earlier. And I was... basically, I don't want to see that because my biggest objections to it actually were George Takei as the lead.
Right.
More so than the idea of going back and exploring things from in between Star Trek VI and the Next Generation time.
Yeah, that could be interesting, going back to 23rd century and seeing some of that.
Yeah, it could. You know, they could go to the end of Star Trek VI. Or the beginning of Generations, where we see the Enterprise B is being launched.
Right.
There's a lot of history to be filled in right
now. Yeah, certainly.
But it's also, I think it's very difficult for the writers to do that and keep the fan base happy. Because when you're going in between like that, you've got to fit everything in between TOS canon and TNG DS9 Voyager canon. And, you know, the fans are so picky. I always remember... Berman saying that in the early days of TNG, they got hundreds of letters because they had a phaser coming out of a photon torpedo tube or something like that on the Enterprise D. And, you know, it's like that kind of stuff doesn't bother me personally.
Right.
Of course, also, as a designer, I know sometimes these things happen. You've got that much stuff that you've got to worry about. But, you know, for some fans, it's a really big issue.
Right.
And so it makes it kind of dangerous going back in between there. The other idea that was being kicked around was an Academy show.
Right.
And I remember writing an article called "Can Star Trek Be Saved by the Bell?"
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about the idea of the next Star Trek series being more like Beverly Hills 90210 or
Yeah.
Saved by the Bell, because it would be focusing on Academy cadets.
Yeah.
And the problem there is that, the idea of having an Academy show, at first glance, I think it sounds like, oh, this might be an interesting idea. But the problem with that kind of show is that it just, if you're going to do it for 7 seasons, it's going to devolve into kind of this kind of teen soap kind of
Right.
show, I think, just because you're dealing with young people who are
Yep.
in school.
Yep.
And you're not going to have the kind of conflict like you get when you're out exploring
Right.
space happening at the Academy in San Francisco.
Right.
So I think it was a hard concept to keep going
Yeah.
for
I mean,
7 seasons. So I didn't want to
even
say
the new
no
movie
there.
like jumped over the Academy years entirely.
You don't want to spend too much time in that.
Yeah.
Now there is a series of novels about the Academy that's out
Oh, really?
from Simon and Schuster, but they're aimed at the teen audience.
Okay.
They're kind of like a Star Trek for the tween and teen
I
audience,
see. Gossip
which
Girl
makes sense,
Academy.
which makes sense because he
Yeah,
does like Kirk's
definitely.
romantic relationships at the Academy
Okay.
or things like that. From a PG
Right,
perspective, of
right.
course. So those were the things being kicked around. So when it came out that, getting back on topic here,
Oh, yeah.
when it came out that Enterprise was going to focus on the 22nd century and the first, the human's first warp ship going out, I thought it was a good idea. I thought that, here's an idea where they don't really have to worry about what came before and how that this is going to fit into canon. They have the opportunity to establish everything that led up to what we now know as canon.
Right.
So they're a bit more free in their writing here, and they only have to worry about a few things like no one can see the Romulans,
Right.
or that's the biggest one
I
really.
think.
There's something about the Tholians as well,
Right.
but it's mainly, no one can see the Romulans. A few things like that.
Yeah. And like even the Vulcans were set up in First Contact, but we really only see them. So they were even free to kind of rewrite Vulcans as what were they like?
Well, they really were because, they're really, prior to Enterprise, the Vulcans, to be probably one of the three most famous races in Star Trek, along with humans and Klingons, prior to Enterprise, there's very little Vulcan
It's
background
amazing.
given. Spock is the only Vulcan I think we ever see in the original series. And we don't really find out much of anything about his culture other than that he's half human.
Right.
There's not very much established about Vulcan culture or the planet,
Like
what it's like there, anything like that.
occasionally we'll go to Vulcan, like I think he
Well,
went
we
through
went
Pon
there.
Far and
Yeah, we did do that in,
we didn't really learn anything about it, and then we did the same thing in Star Trek 3. We went to Vulcan to bring him back to life, but we didn't learn anything about the culture. It was just very like heavy religious. They're obviously monk-like and they have no emotions, but we don't actually learn anything about what the culture is like, what the government's like, what they think of humans. None of this comes out.
Unlike, say, on Deep Space Nine, like we know so much about the Cardassians, for example.
Exactly, right.
We didn't have that kind of development for the Vulcans. And then when we get into the new series, I mean, Next Generation, when is the first time we see a Vulcan? I mean, maybe we see one in the hallway in Encounter to Farpoint or something,
It's
but
possible. Do we even?
I don't even know if there's one there. I'd have to go back and like really pay
Yeah.
attention. But there was really no Vulcan presence on the Next
Yeah, not really. I mean, I
Generation.
know Spock shows up eventually and
He
does some things,
shows up.
but it very much not a Vulcan show. We
We
obviously
get
get to
Sarek comes on the
Sarek
ship,
came on.
with and mind melds with Picard,
Right.
right, in Sarek.
But we probably learned more about the Romulans on Next Gen than we actually learned about the Vulcans, because we had, what was her name, Sela.
Yeah.
For several episodes.
And plus we had the Vulcans as a foe. So we learn, I mean the Romulans as a foe.
Right.
So we learn more about the Romulans. Right. And the Vulcans, you know, you don't see many Vulcan officers. You don't.
Yeah.
You don't really find out. They just weren't really used very much.
Yeah.
So it really was Enterprise that painted the history of the Vulcans as we are. And,
Right. And
which is interesting because, you know, a lot of fans, I think, get upset about the way the Vulcans are portrayed in Enterprise because they're not Spock.
Right.
But it makes sense. You know, we're talking about, we know from Spock that the Vulcans, had a history that was more violent and that they learned to bottle up their emotions. And, I guess people expect that that was thousands of years ago as opposed to 100 years ago.
Yeah.
But I think the way the Vulcans are portrayed in Enterprise shows an evolution, it shows a realistic evolution in a society, I think, unlike the Klingons and Enterprise, who are pretty much the Klingons we get everywhere.
That's true. Yeah. I do think it's interesting. Like we see an evolution in humans from the original series into Voyager. I think there's been a, showing how they change from the 23rd to the 24th century, getting even more utopian and losing their roots, with money and
especially if you throw Enterprise in there, the humans of Enterprise's time on.
Right. So then if you add in Enterprise, then wow, humans really have come a long way. So it would have been, I think, bizarre to show Vulcans being the same way as Tuvok.
Yeah.
You know, I think it could have
worked because it's kind of established that the Vulcan as a technological culture is much more ancient than Earth.
This is true.
But I think when you're writing drama, I think that the way they handled it was appropriate
to show
how the humans and Vulcans were and then how they both evolved into what we know in the 24th century. So I like that.
Really pleased with the way Vulcans have been handled. Mm.
Yeah. So I thought it was a good idea. And then when the series premiered, I was really excited to see it. Of course, I couldn't get it right away. Being in Japan, I had to get my father to record on videotape back then and mail me VHS tapes.
Wow.
So I didn't get to see it until it had already been on for a few months. But when it came on, you know, I thought it was great. And Broken Bow, I think it would be hard, even for fans who maybe don't like Enterprise all that much. I think it would be hard for anyone to argue too seriously that Broken Bow isn't the most polished pilot of any of the series.
Yeah, I think I was saying that to you recently, that, you know, you go back and watch Farpoint or Caretaker, any of the next gen or original series pilots. This it was just from head to toe. You could tell they had thought out the whole world. They had really spent the money on the sets. They'd really cast it really interesting, really, really interestingly, and a diverse cast. And it just works really well as a 90-minute story.
It does, and you know, attention to detail on that one. I actually, I either read or it's in the extras in the box sets for Enterprise. But the cornfield in Broken Bow there that the Klingons running through, that they actually had that corn grown for them because they couldn't get a field at the time of year they needed the shooting or something like that.
Wow.
But I mean, they really went all out on that episode. And I mean, maybe it's good and it's bad. I think that maybe what happened a little bit is that Broken Bow was such a good episode that the expectations were through the roof for what was going to come next. And I think then we almost immediately turn talky, you know, as opposed to the special effects, we kind of came back inside. Like we were talking about earlier for the next JJ movie, needing to maybe become a little bit more introspective and philosophical. I think Enterprise took a really quick turn in that direction, which again, I think was appropriate for what they were trying to do, but I'm just not sure that's what the fans were looking for.
Right. Yeah, I could see that. You know, when you just watch them all on DVD like I've been doing, it's a lot easier just to really enjoy the character moments. But when you're watching it week to week, I think you really do need an injection of action and of like real visual interest to keep you interested. And they had some really good episodes early on, though. The Andorian Vulcan arc was really interesting. The Andorian incident and then Shadows of Pajem. But I guess if the fans were angry about the way Vulcans were being portrayed, they're just going to be even more unhappy with those episodes.
Yeah, I think, you know, the next episode after Broken Bow was Fight or Flight.
Yeah.
And so much of the focus on that episode was on Hoshi being uncomfortable about being in space, if I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, was, again, like I said before, I think it's good Star Trek. That's what you know, Star Trek talks about. But that might not have been the best follow-up to Broken Bow, and may not have gotten things off on the best foot.
Yeah, when it's all the Enterprise, it's weird. At the start of the show, and when that's all you have, it sort of solidifies in your mind what the show is. And you're thinking, oh, the whole show is just going to be them, you know, not really having a villain and just talking about these characters being scared. And I don't want to watch this show.
Yeah, yeah, that happens. And you mentioned Shadows of Pajem a minute ago, which was a really good episode with the Vulcan spy facility under the monastery, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the conflict with the Andorians. And the follow-up to that was Shuttle Pod 1, which is Malcolm and Trip trapped in a shuttle pod for the whole episode talking to each other.
Like so a bottle episode on steroids.
it's like okay, so here we go. We've got Shadows of Pajem. Good. We're picking up speed, and then we've got Shuttle Pod 1.
Right.
And again, it's not that Shuttle Pod 1 is
bad
as Star Trek, but when you're in that earlier in that first 15 episodes there, and you're trying to establish the show, and you've already got franchise fatigue going on.
Right.
And you're trying to pull in an audience onto to a station like UPN at the time. It's kind of tough. So
definitely, maybe they should have held on to some of those concepts till season two. Let people get an idea of, you know, this is the show we're making. It is really interesting, and there is great stuff we're going to show you. And then a show like Shuttle Pod 1 doesn't seem like such a boring thing. You can actually dial in and say, You know, why are they doing an episode like this?
Yeah. If you throw it in like that, I mean, you look at The Next Generation. One of the best episodes of The Next Generation is The Inner Light, where Picard lives out this other life after the space probe. And he's only out, I think, for like, what is it, 30 seconds or something? It's
a
very short time.
It.
But for him, it's like 70 something years, I think.
Right.
Or on Deep Space Nine, The Visitor is a great episode. I mean, these are two of, I think, the best Star Trek episodes, but they're both slow. But they're in the midst of this established series.
Right.
And so they work.
Right. And I think there's examples of that in Voyager 2. There's an episode that was all about this alien culture that had a very skewed idea of what Voyager was like, that they were very militaristic and that they had caused this civil war or something. And I think if it had been first season, it would have been similar to like what people thought of Enterprise. But because it wasn't until the fifth season, people already knew what Voyager was, and they were able to buy into an episode like that.
Yeah, that's right. So we go through. Apart from the stories, and here's something that has always impressed me as a designer with Enterprise is that it was an incredible challenge, I think, for the designers on Enterprise to capture that feeling of retro.
Yeah.
But not make it look ridiculous to us, because, you know, when we're walking around, well, today we're walking around with iPad, but even when Enterprise came on, you know, we had pocket PCs, we had these little, you know, touchpin palms and pocket PCs and the iPod was actually released in the same year that Enterprise premiered. When we have things like that, you know, the props from TOS, it's just not going to work. If you try to say, okay, well, Spock had shoulder problems and had to get massages from Dr. McCoy because he had to carry that big tricorder around on away missions.
Right.
And now 100 years ago, Archer had to have a yeoman carry, two yeomen carry a tricorder around with him on away missions because it used to be so big. You know, you can't do that.
Right.
So you gotta make something that looks real to us and still works. And I thought they did a brilliant job from maintaining things like the earpiece mm-hmm. that Hoshi had.
Hoshi gets to wear the little earpiece. Yeah.
The science viewer, mm-hmm. Like Spock had.
Yeah.
The feel of the display graphics at all on the bridge.
Right.
And the way the panels are done and everything. I thought they did a really good job of kind of making you feel like you're going back in time
yeah.
and you're used to Voyager.
Yeah, and it sort of takes advantage of what we know of as NASA today. Whereas maybe back in the original series, they didn't have a NASA to look at in the same way we do now with actual space missions going on semi-regularly. So they could sort of take what we're doing today and what they did in the original series and figure out what might be in the middle. And I think they did a great job. Like the suits they wear look less like pajamas and more like, you know, NASA suits, which I think
is
great.
Well, you know, I was noticing today that in the Zindi, I think it is, but when they're back on Earth and Archer is talking and the Admiral's uniforms, they actually have neckties on.
Oh yeah,
they look like U.S. Navy.
Mm-hmm.
They're definitely U.S. Navy inspired,
right?
Uniforms, but he's got a white shirt and a blue necktie on.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
that
great.
Kind of thing, and like the baseball caps. That
oh
they
yeah,
wear you know,
he wears
it's
a
nice
cap.
Touch.
He's got a dog on board the ship. You know,
oh,
stuff that
yeah.
just it wouldn't happen in the 23rd century, and certainly not the 24th century. But because we're back in time, you know. Some of the stuff that we're doing today is carrying on. Like, I loved what they did with First Contact, sort of the same way of showing us what the world is going to look like as it points towards what we already know of as Star Trek.
Yeah. Yeah, these things are well done. And the Enterprise itself, the NX-01 itself, is, I think, really a brilliant design. The styling of it is very retro. The hull plating,
yeah.
it feels very organic.
Yeah,
you know the ships, you know the Enterprise D and Enterprise E and Voyager and all these ships feel far away.
Yes,
the way they're built, but the Enterprise, the NX-01, both on the inside and on the outside, feels very tangible and organic
yeah.
to me, like something that we would build. And it's done CGI, which it's just, mm-hmm. I think it's very beautiful. And the shuttle pods as well, like
oh, yeah.
you mentioned Strange New World. When the shuttle comes down to the planet in Strange New World, the lighting, and people have to remember this stuff is done CGI. I don't think, there are no models in Enterprise, I don't think, are they? I think it's all CGI.
Yeah, I believe you're right about that.
I mean, it looks so real. And the lighting and the styling is so well done. And these are little touches for me in Enterprise that I think really have gone underappreciated
yeah.
amongst the fan base. And I think that the show doesn't get the credit that it deserves. Now, it's not, as a series, yeah, it's not on par with Deep Space Nine or
yeah, probably
Voyager
not.
Next Generation
yeah.
as a series. But it definitely has some really great work in it and some great storytelling
yeah.
that I think goes underappreciated.
Yeah, I think if you go back and watch it and think of it as, I don't know, just don't think of it as like this is the only Star Trek on the air and you have to pin all your hopes to it being the greatest thing. Just watch it as this is some people in the future and... You know, let's think about what life is going to be like when we actually have to start poking out into the unknown. And I think they really nailed it in a lot of the episodes with real human stories.
Yeah, I think they did. And I think that's what they were going for. I think the problem was it may have been a miscalculation by Berman and Braga about what the audience wanted.
Yeah, that's very true.
what they did, and I hear this from fans too, that Berman and Braga don't respect Star Trek and they don't know Star Trek, and they, you know, I don't really think it's that they don't know Star Trek, especially not Berman. I mean, he was around from the beginning of Next
Right.
Generation. And I actually think that he did an admirable job over the years of trying to keep things fairly true to what Gene wanted, without making it so stuffy that you just can't write the show anymore. But I do think that what they did is that they made the show they wanted to make, and it wasn't necessarily the show that the fans wanted.
Right.
And I think that that they succeeded in making the show that they set out to make. And I think that what then happened to the show, which is what we should talk about next, is how the show changed course. And for me, this all comes down to ratings and studio executives.
Do you? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it's not so much that watching Enterprise season one or season two, it's not so much that I, as a Star Trek fan, felt that there's something wrong with this show, although I felt maybe it's getting a little bit too slow sometimes for the bigger audience. But I think that the ratings were suffering.
Right.
And that was because of franchise fatigue, one. Two, it was because it was on UPN. And it was on UPN. Okay. I don't know if you remember this. And I think a lot of fans who kind of came in on Voyager maybe don't remember how Voyager came about. But in 1995, when Voyager premiered, Paramount finally launched their own TV network.
Right, exactly.
Which they had tried to do a few times before and hadn't worked out. And Voyager was the flagship show of UPN.
Because they've been doing it as a syndicated show for so long and showing it on
Next
other
Generation,
stations.
Right. Next Generation and Deep Space Nine were both fully in syndication from first run. So Voyager, I mean, in fact, Voyager came about because UPN wanted a Star Trek show to be the flagship of this new network. And, but over time, UPN evolved and it kind of got away to where Star Trek wasn't really a very good fit for UPN anymore. And by the time Voyager ended its run, you had a UPN that was really into pro wrestling, top model, all this kind of pop. It sounds funny to say pop culture when we're talking about Star Trek, but this kind of, this type of culture, you know, reality show type culture stuff. And Star Trek really didn't fit in very well anymore, but they knew that they can make money off Star Trek. So they want to do another Star Trek series and it's going to be on UPN because, well, it's Paramount making it and that's their TV network.
Right.
And I think that already in the first season of Enterprise, we were already running into problems where you have Berman and Braga have this vision of a show that I think was pretty true to Star Trek's ideals, but it was a terrible fit for a TV network that was showing top model and wrestling. And that rift kept growing and growing there, I think. And so then when the ratings started falling, I mean, Star Trek fans, UPN was not going to pull in overall ratings by bringing Star Trek fans in to watch Enterprise and then hang on to them to watch wrestling and top model and the other shows that were on. So it was kind of, it was not really beneficial in the net, to the network, I think, to have Enterprise on there. And so there, the show suffered, I think, in terms of support from the top office.
They just, they didn't have, I mean, you even saw that in the end of Voyager, that the changing face of UPN started really affecting the show. And I remember, you know, every other commercial in Voyager being a commercial for wrestling. And it just didn't, it didn't make any sense.
Well, and then you had the wrestling crossover episode.
The, whatever that was called, Tsumkase or something, where The Rock actually shows up and...
And The Rock is there.
Like, you know. Seven of Nine. That was obviously not something the writer said, we want to do.
Yeah, I don't think so. Like, okay, we have this great idea for a story, okay? What we need is we need Seven of Nine... wrestling, you know, I really don't think that happened in the writer's room.
And you know, it is a problem. Like, I don't know where Star Trek would succeed on TV right now, especially on the networks. You have a show
it wouldn't work on the networks. I don't think so.
And you have a show like Firefly that was so good, but Fox couldn't make it work. And other shows have come and gone. I don't know, maybe the 90s were this strange time when it just, they could get enough people watching that they actually had two Star Trek shows on the air for several years.
Well, quite a few years, yeah. From 93, yeah, when Deep Space Nine started, until 99.
Right.
When Voyager ended, we had two series on all the time.
But I feel like the face of TV has changed so much, and UPN had changed so much becoming reality TV that it just wasn't interested in the short stories that Enterprise wanted to tell.
Yeah, definitely. It was a bad situation.
Yeah.
I think for Star Trek and for Enterprise and for the actors, who I think were doing a great job. It was the end of a run. I mean, it was, the 90s were kind of a golden age for Star Trek, no doubt. And for science fiction, you know, we had the X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
We had the unprecedented year, and I think it was 94 when we had the X-Files and Next Generation both nominated for Best Drama.
Oh, wow.
And the Emmys in the same year. I mean,
that's
incredible. You never get science fiction shows for Best Drama. Huh. And you had X-Files and Next Generation both.
That's incredible.
In the same year. It was really unprecedented. But that was really like 94, 95. Right. It was really, really the heyday for Star Trek. So at any rate, the show changed course.
Yeah.
And
They call it the new direction is how they build it.
And so what's your take on the reasoning of the change course, if there's any more to it than just chasing ratings?
Yeah, it's really strange to me why they went in the direction they did, because it seemed to me that what's killed a lot of these shows is having too much continuity and having new viewers not be able to pick up on what's happening.
Right. Like Deep Space Nine kind of got into that.
Deep Space Nine had that problem. I think part of what happened was 24 had become a huge hit by this time. And one of the producers on, I don't know, well, Manny Coto is who I'm talking about. Manny Coto was on Enterprise at this time. I'm not sure if he was on...
He came on season 4, right?
He actually was working on season 3.
Was he working on season 3 and then he kind of took over?
And then he took over for season 4.
Season 4, yeah, okay.
And I don't remember if he was working on 24 at the time or if he left Enterprise and did 24 later. But
I don't recall either.
I think there was this idea of, if we get people hooked with this really big premise, they'll stick with us through the whole season. Like maybe we're getting people like drifting in and out of the show. They don't worry if they miss a week. What we'll do is we'll tell them that, you know, Los Angeles or the Earth is going to get destroyed, and that'll just get them coming back every week. And it's an interesting idea.
Is it Star Trek?
Is it Star Trek? Yeah.
That's the question. Yeah. Because my thing on, okay, so season 3, we'll talk about season 3 with the Zindi arc. It's probably the only season of Star Trek in the 28 seasons where we actually have that type of arc. I mean, Deep Space Nine kind of has it in the later seasons, but even then it was kind of different because the Deep Space Nine thing had been building and building and building.
Right,
and it was a kind of a natural evolution of what had happened even on the Next Generation towards the end.
There's that word natural.
Bajorans. Yeah.
This was so unnatural.
It was just out of the blue.
They dropped the temporal Cold War and just said, oh, there's this area of space and there's this alien. And for some reason, they're angry with us. We're going to forget exploring and we're going to fight them.
That's right. Because they did kind of give up the exploring. They did.
I mean, they never even got back to exploring. Season 4 was more of a, it was all closer to Earth. All the stories in season 4. The diplomacy season. So it was so strange. There was no, like, if we had had some hints that this was going to happen, maybe it would have been better. But for fans of the show, it must have come out of nowhere.
Yeah, it did. It just completely came out of nowhere. And so, yeah, so for me, for the watching the Zindi arc, it's a little bit different watching it when it was on the first time.
Yeah.
Did you watch it each week when it was on the first time, or have you only watched it on DVD?
So what I've learned as I'm rewatching is that I must have tuned out at some point, I don't know, halfway through, because there's several episodes later in the season. I have one more episode to watch that I think is actually the only episode of Star Trek I've never seen. And I've been watching several of these episodes for the first time. So I think it really lost me just because every week I was hearing about the Zindi, and I don't care about the Zindi. And we're flying into, you know, space that just isn't interesting. There's nothing to explore, and Star Trek has always been about exploring.
Yeah.
And so I definitely remember tuning out and saying, this is not interesting anymore.
Yeah, I know. I hear from a lot of people who kind of tuned out at that point too. And well, I asked how you had watched it, because kind of what I remember about it in first run was that you had this season long arc going, but you did have some episodes along the way that were kind of standalone. You kind of broke out of that Zindi mold just from time to time, like
slightly, yes.
Let's see, like what was the, well, Carpenter Street.
Carpenter Street is the most.
But you still had Zindi there,
right?
Didn't you? It was Zindi coming back time. You know?
That episode sort of feels like Fringe. I don't know if you watch Fringe these days, but it felt very much like a modern day X-Files sort of storyline.
Yeah, I've seen some of Fringe.
Which one was the most?
Let's see. There was one. Well, now this season does have one of the great Star Trek episodes in it, I think, though, which is Twilight. Is it Twilight?
Which one was Twilight?
Twilight, where it's in the far future and T'Pol is taking care of Archer.
Good.
That was a really good episode.
Place after,
but it was
Earth's
kind
destruction.
Of
destruction.
Yeah, it was after, so they weren't chasing the Zindi in there so much. So
that was really good. Another
that's
one
where you break out.
Where they sort of broke out of it was E Squared, where another Enterprise shows up that had been transported into the past.
Yeah,
and they sort of spent the whole episode just dealing with that. That was a pretty interesting episode later in the season.
That was pretty good. Yeah, I remember that one. And it was a little bit of Voyager, Equinox, where the other ship shows up.
Yes.
A little bit of that going on there. But and what was their North Star? Was the Wild West remake again? Right.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about North Star.
North Star. It's like every Star Trek series has to have a Wild West episode.
Really?
You know, we had it in TOS, and we had it in TNG.
Yeah. I could sort of feel in that episode that they were bored with the Zindi and didn't know what to do about it.
Let's just throw in some boots and hats, right?
They're supposed to be like on this mission, but they're like stopping at this Wild West planet, and they even tell them at the end of the episode, you know, we can't take you home because we're doing this other thing, but someone's totally gonna come back for you. Don't worry,
we'll be back. You know, we'll make sure. Look, we promised Khan we'd be back, so
exactly.
Don't worry. Actually, they didn't promise Khan yet. That's still in their future, right?
Right.
So the writers promised Khan.
I understand.
So, well, at any rate, if you watch it on DVD and you just kind of go through, you know, you get a little bit more feeling of the cohesion of this Zindi arc, I think.
It kind of works better.
First air, you get, there's some breaks here along the way. And when it was on the first time, I think when you watch it on DVD, if you just watch a couple of episodes every day, you know, you can get through it in a week and a half.
Right. I think that's
and you can kind of feel like, okay, well, maybe this is an interesting story arc.
Right.
I'm not sure if it's Star Trek or not, but just as science fiction, okay, here it's an arc.
Right.
But when it was on the first time, by the end of the season, you were kind of like, can we kind of get this over with now?
Totally.
And it's kind of going on and on too long.
I mean, where it really kicks in is where we sort of learn that they're not evil, that there's this other, these other people who are telling them lies. And we actually have to start teaming up with some of the Zindi factions.
Yeah.
And then it actually becomes more Star Trek, where it's more about, we've got to convince them, you know, not just kill them, but convince them that they need to work with us. But it comes so late in the season. And by then, I think people were just already so bored with the idea of the Zindi.
Yeah, I think so too. And then we get to the end of the season, and they get home.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's everyone's favorite Nazis coming back, right?
Nazis.
And not just Nazis, but remember that this happened not long, just a few years after Star Trek Nemesis was in the theater, with a storyline that focused on the Romulans and the Remans, and we got to see quite a lot of Remans, which we had never seen before. And what do we have at the end of Zero Hour, the very last scene of Zero Hour?
We have
an alien that looks like a Reman wearing a Nazi uniform.
Yep. It looks like a Reman Nazi.
Yes. It looks like a Reman Nazi.
Just added.
And it's not a Reman.
No.
You know, sorry, guys who haven't watched this yet, 7 years later.
Yeah.
For the spoiler, but it's not a Reman. And but I remember spending the entire summer debating with Star Trek fans about, what is this alien? Is this a Reman?
Oh,
is it not a Reman? What's a Reman? When we've never seen Remans before, except in Nemesis.
Yes. So
I mean, we've heard of them, I guess, but we've never really seen them.
Yep.
Why is there now a Reman in the middle of Nazi? World War II? But at the same time, I was thinking, like, you know, if it is a Reman, this could be a really interesting twist they've thrown in here.
In theory.
But, you know, it's like, oh, great, we're going back to Nazis again. But, hey, what if it's a Reman? What if there's some kind of tie-in to Next Generation time?
In theory.
But, of course, no. It was nothing like that.
I actually think I may have actually tuned in to the season finale thinking, you know, I sort of missed the whole Zindi arc, but I'd like to see the end of it and see, you know, I know they're not going to be doing the Zindi next year. What's gonna be the future of the show? And then it ends with an alien Nazi. And I did not watch season 4 until a couple years ago.
You just couldn't bring yourself to continue, right?
It's they just kept making these bad choices, which it really frustrates me.
Well, luckily they wrapped that up.
They did.
In season 4, and then season 4. One parallel I found interesting is that after Stormfront, the next episode was Home.
Right.
And if you remember from The Next Generation, after The Best of Both Worlds, the next episode was Family.
Oh, right.
And it was kind of a parallel to Next Generation's, whether it was intentional or not. I think it maybe was kind of intentional.
Right.
Not like, hey, we're going to copy Next Generation, but like, we've just been through this great, you know, trying time for our characters.
Right.
Let's kind of bring them home and kind of calm things down a little bit.
Right.
And so then after that, you know, we start getting into what I think was an interesting concept, which was doing these three-part story arcs.
Yeah.
And then we also start doing what I kind of felt that Enterprise should have done from the very beginning, which was to start actually exploring elements of the original series.
Right.
Which I wish they had done starting from the very beginning, but at least I wish they had done that instead of the Zindi arc in season 3.
Right. If they had done season 4, like if they'd done the Zindi as just a couple episode arc and then just started with Home as your, you know, episode 3 of season 3, I think the show actually would have gone on, because what they ended up doing was coming up with some interesting stories and then spending enough time developing the story that you really got invested in it, but not so much time that you got really bored with it. And that was a key, I think, to the success of season four for me.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I think the show would have the key to keeping the show going with the broader fan base was to tap into that desire for people had that desire to find out how did we get to TOS?
Right.
And I kind of think that's what Manny Koto felt too, that this show should be about the road to TOS.
Right.
And when he really took charge in season four, I think we start to see that, we start to see more exploration of the Vulcans. With the three-parter on
Right.
Vulcan, was that the
Yep.
Forge Awakening,
Right. That was really.
Kishara?
It's been a while since I saw these episodes, so I'm gonna have to go on. But I
Well, same
do.
for me. I have not watched a lot of these in quite a while,
But yes, the three part on Vulcan was great.
but the arcs, you've got the augments, what was it, Borderland, Cold Station 12, the augments,
Right. Those are
which tie
great.
into ultimately tie into Data, because you've got Dr. Noonien seeing Ancestor, I guess,
Right.
there,
Yep.
and then you get the explanation of why the Klingons in the original series don't have
Right.
forehead
Which I
ridges,
think
which,
worked really well, actually. I was kind of impressed with that.
I think it works, and I guess they felt like we've just got to settle this.
Right.
But I have to admit that I like Worf's explanation better in Trials and Tribulations on Deep Space Nine, when he just said it's a long story and we
Right.
don't talk about it
Like, talk
without
about it.
Summers.
Yeah, I kind of feel that episode actually still works. I went back and watched that one recently, and it actually, his explanation actually still works when
It
you
is a long story, right?
it's a long story and
He
it's
was being
rather
honest.
embarrassing.
It's embarrassing, yeah.
So yeah, I think they did anger some fans if I remember correctly, but
Well, there is a little bit of an issue there with that explanation, though, which is that you have Klingons from was in The Trouble with Tribbles, you have Koloth. Is that right?
Right.
Is Koloth in Trouble
It
with
was, yeah,
Tribbles?
you're right, Koloff.
And you have him again in Deep Space Nine in the episode, what was the name of the episode, when they go off with Dax. You have Kang and Koloth
Yes,
in
I
the
know the episode
station,
you're speaking of.
and they go off with the Dax, and they have the updated look.
Right.
So there's a little glitch in there, I mean, it's one of those nitpicky things which I don't actually care about personally, but the fans who do get upset about this
Right.
explanation, I think.
Well, in theory, he could have, if there was a cure found at some point
Well, that's
between
true.
TOS and, I guess, motion picture. We're
Yeah.
assuming there's some sort of cure found, and so Koloth was able to inject himself, and boom, now he's Klingon looking again.
Yeah, that's true. That could
So
work.
I
Or,
think it works for me.
they could just have plastic surgery because
I guess that's possible
they
too.
do that a lot on the show when they need to go down and spy on people,
Yeah.
like in Riker in First Contact.
Right.
But of course, they can't deal with the anatomy, but that's for another podcast.
Right,
So.
right, right.
Anyway, the series went on, and I actually think that it went quite well in season four.
Season four, really good. I mean, then we even got the entirely in the mirror universe two-parter. That was
Okay.
fantastic.
Yeah, no, okay. Well, tell me what you think about that episode,
Oh,
because I.
are you going to be negative on it?
No,
This is
well,
disappointing.
not really. This is my thing. I actually just rewatched that last week.
Okay.
I can never complain about that episode because they have Empress Hoshi in there,
Empress Hoshi.
I like the episode. This is the deal. I
Okay.
feel like they wanted to do a mirror. I love the Mirror Universe episodes, by the way. Deep
Okay.
Space Nine ones, I think, are great. I
Especially Deep Space
think
Nine, yeah.
they wanted to do a mirror episode, which I think was good. I liked the idea that they found the Defiant that was lost in the
Yeah.
original series, because you had this loose connection
Yep.
there, and they could explore it because they were in the Mirror Universe.
Yep.
That worked really well. I felt like the story kind of didn't go anywhere.
Maybe if I rewatched it, it's entirely possible that when I saw it, there was this whole like, oh wow, they're on the Defiant set, which looks like the Enterprise, and
yeah, and yeah. It was beautifully done. Yeah. I mean, the visuals, the TOS visuals,
yeah,
were just beautiful.
And they even had everybody wearing the original uniforms.
Yep, and they had Archer in Kirk's green tunic.
Exactly,
which was awesome.
So it may be that I got caught up in all that, and I missed that the story was a little lacking. That's very possible.
Yeah, I think that the writers and the producers got caught up in that,
yeah.
And the story suffered a little bit. The Tholians were great. Seeing the actual Tholian,
right? Because they had like a Tholian in the brig, or
and the Tholian ships and the Tholian web being redone was just beautiful. It's like a playground for TOS fans.
Right.
That episode is, it's just like being in a candy shop.
Yeah.
I think the story would have worked better for me if Enterprise was going to go 7 seasons. And they were going to do several of these Mirror Universe episodes, like Deep Space Nine did.
Right.
And this was the beginning of it. And then we found out what happened. Well, I don't think they would have killed Archer and had Empress Hoshi if they were going to do that.
Probably not.
I think they knew because, you know, I mean, this happens. There are only really two more episodes after this because the finale of Enterprise is a Next Generation episode. So there were only two episodes of Enterprise after this Mirror Universe episode. So they knew that this is it. I think they kind of tried to fill everything in. It's kind of like with the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie that was done a few years ago.
Yes.
Where they obviously knew they weren't going to get any money to make the restaurant at the end of the universe, or Life, the Universe, and everything. And they sure weren't going to get any money to make So Long, Thanks for All the Fish.
Yeah.
So they tried to throw everything into this one movie. And it's like, I like the movie, but it feels panicked, and you're not supposed to panic in The Hitchhiker's Guide. You get your towel and your peril sensitive sunglasses and you don't panic. And it says that right on the cover. And I think that they kind of tried too hard to shove everything in because they knew they weren't going to make a sequel. Mm. And that's kind of what I feel in this, in A Mirror Darkly, was like, this is our one chance to play in the Mirror Universe. So let's cover all the bases. And I felt like the story kind of teetered out at the end. It kind of left me wanting more from the story, I guess. So
yeah, I guess it could have been more interesting if they'd done like a one-parter, just a one-off.
One-parter. That's a novel concept in season 4.
Yes. Anywho, that just introduced the Mirror Universe, and then they'd come back to it in season 5. I could see that.
Yeah, but that would have been cool.
Yeah, I think
I do like it, and it is like I said, it is like being in a candy shop for TOS fans. So then the series wraps up, and we have demons, and we have Terra Prime,
right?
And we kind of jump ahead, and we get what the series should have gone 7 seasons and ended with, which is the founding of the Federation,
right? Yeah,
but we can't get there on a proper timeline, so we just kind of jumped ahead. So how did you feel about that?
Well, the actual episode, These Are the Voyages, it's just a really bad episode. And
well, it's a Valentine to Star Trek. That's what we were told.
I think the difficulty is they were making a Star Trek finale, and I just wanted an Enterprise finale.
Yeah, that's a good point. They weren't making an Enterprise finale. They were making a Star Trek finale. Yeah.
And so it was all based around Riker and Troy coming back. And it just, I don't know, it sort of petered off, and I think they sort of...
And it takes place in the middle of the Pegasus, I think, right? The seventh season Next Generation episode.
And then it doesn't make... If you go back and watch Pegasus, it doesn't actually work in continuity.
Right.
Not to mention everybody's much pudgier than they were at the time. I think...
But Riker still has his swagger.
He still has his swagger. Yeah, I love Jonathan Frakes, but yeah, when I finish my run through, I think I'm going to pretend that Terra Prime is the actual finale.
Yeah. I think a lot of people do that.
Yeah. I don't know.
All right, so I guess in wrapping up then, final impressions of Enterprise as a whole series, just from beginning to end.
Yeah,
and is it is was it Was it Star Trek? Was it good or bad for the franchise?
Well,
What are your thoughts on
my
that?
thoughts so far, and we might have to come back to this after I finish watching season four again, but my main thoughts are that season one and two are great Star Trek. They bring it back to the roots of being all about exploring, about meeting new races. The way Archer, or the way, now I'm blanking on his name, the guy who plays Archer.
God. Oh, now you ask me, and now I can't remember
See,
Scott Bakula.
Scott Bakula. The way Bakula plays Archer is just so great, as he's just this guy. I know we're back to guys again, but he's not this polished Starfleet captain. He's the first captain who has to go out and talk to people, and he doesn't have all the protocols, but he's really trying to make it work. And I think the first couple seasons are great Star Trek in that way, bringing us back to what TOS and Voyager did so well. Season three does an interesting, it's an interesting concept, and I think it's handled about halfway well. I would not have done it again. I think I would have liked all those episodes back to do different stories, do interesting stories every week. And then season four, I really think is great. And what they were plan their plans for season five were going to be even better, I think, to show
Oh, I think so,
the
yeah.
origins of the Borg. I don't know if you've seen the images of the NX-01 refit, but it looks sort of halfway between the NX-01 and the 1701. It
Oh, I don't
actually
see that.
has a whole, I'll have to, maybe we can put this in the show notes if we have such a thing.
Yeah.
It has sort of the Constitution class engineering section put onto it, and they probably have some new sets they were going to put in there. So it would have started looking more like that. We would have gotten to the Romulan War, and eventually actually seen the birth of the Federation. You know, naturally,
Natural, yeah,
not
happened
just skip,
naturally.
not just skip forward to it, but actually show it happening, and that would have been
Right.
really great. So I'm disappointed that it ended when it did. And I'm
Yeah, because to get to the founding of the Federation too, you have to get through the reconciliation between the Vulcans and the Andorians,
Yep, and
which we never got to see. I
that
mean,
would have been so interesting
how
to
are these
see.
guys who are at their throat at each other's
Yep.
throats in season one?
Right.
How do they end up at that ceremony?
And we had the Vulcan arc in season four that had the Vulcans finding the Kirshar, I believe I'm getting that term right.
I think that's right,
This
yeah.
ancient religious document, I guess, that actually revolutionized the Vulcan way of life. But we're never actually able to go back to it and see how that actually changes them
Yeah.
until Spock. And as we've discussed, especially in TOS and Next Gen and DS9, we don't see the Vulcan culture, and so we're never able to see that. Whereas I think season five and six and seven could have shown us more about the Vulcans becoming the Vulcans we know today.
Yeah, they could have. And if that had happened, I think, fans' views of how
Oh
Vulcans were
yeah.
handled in Enterprise would be completely different, because
Yep.
then you would have seen that evolution.
Yep, you would have seen an arc, not
It would have
just
made more sense to people why they acted one way
Right.
or why they acted differently at the beginning of
Precisely.
Enterprise
Yep.
versus what we know as Vulcans.
Yeah.
And like you said, the Romulan War. See, that would have been a natural war
I
to
know.
have in the series, unlike the forced Zindi conflict.
Right.
The Romulan War is something that we all know took place.
Right.
We just don't know anything about it.
And I guess
So
the
that's,
timing didn't work out
yeah,
to
natural
do the
thing.
Romulan War in season three.
Well, it could be that, or I still think that there were other people, making or
Yeah.
pushing the course of the show in different directions. And if you said, well, okay, we'll make it more exciting, we'll do a season-long arc and we'll do the Romulan War. And they say, well, the Romulans, I mean, again, the
Yeah, it's
Romulans
true. They
again,
say it had
so
been played out. Let's have a new alien. Let's
yeah,
have
let's do something
six new
completely
aliens
new.
that are
Let's
all.
yeah, let's have six new aliens. Was it six and one was the bird species was extinct, or were
Right. It
there
may have been five, and then
seven?
the eight, and then the avians.
I think the avians were the sixth and they were
Yeah.
extinct. Yeah, it's like, let's not just have one new alien, let's
Yes.
have 5. No, make it 6.
make it 6. Yeah, so I could...
And like let's have one that requires an aquarium to be on the ship all the time. So
I could see where they were going with that. I just
although I say that, and Titan has such a crew member.
Oh, is that right?
In the novels, which is why I always say that if Titan were made into a TV series, the CGI requirements would be,
that'd be difficult.
Substantial because it's a regular member of the crew.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, that's for another time.
Yes.
So I guess basically our conclusion... Our feeling is that Enterprise is a good series that maybe got off track a bit.
Yeah.
Possibly through forces beyond its control.
Yeah.
Thanks to the network and chasing ratings, which is what all TV shows do this day. And, and just maybe recommend everybody who has a bad impression of Enterprise from watching it in first run to go back and get the DVDs and watch it again.
Definitely watch again, especially seasons 1, 2, and 4, because I think you'll just have a totally different impression when you're able to watch the episodes just one after another, and especially not to have to think of it as being, this is what Star Trek is now. Just think of it as, this is a part of Star Trek.
And it's not a follow-up to Voyager. So,
like,
when you watch Archer, don't compare Archer. Don't expect Archer to be Janeway or Sisko or Picard, these bold leaders, refined leaders.
Right.
He's the first captain. He's the first one out there, and it's all new to him. And he reacts the way we would react.
Right.
I mean, he has his training, but still, it's the first time to meet these aliens who aren't Vulcans.
Yeah.
And people like Hoshi, it's her first time flying on a starship.
Yeah.
And the other thing I think is, you know, watch it with an eye for the design. Mm-hmm. You know, watch how they handle the interiors and watch how they handle the technologies and the organic nature of the ships and the shuttles and so forth and see. I think people would have a new appreciation for just how well the creative staff did on that series in a very difficult job of bringing an old look to a new series.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, especially if you compare it to the first season of Next Gen, it feels so much more put together. It feels like there's this whole world that you can really just dive into. And that's what I've been enjoying about watching it.
Most definitely. Okay. Well, we're running pretty long.
We are.
So we'll head out for this week's Ready Room. Just in closing, though, I want to remind everyone to visit our website at trek.fm. We have podcasts like this one and articles, news, trivia, polls. We've got all kinds of Star Trek stuff on there for you to have fun with. We have free wallpapers as well, things for you to pick up. And for every Thursday, we have another podcast, the Hyper Channel. It's a video podcast that comes out with Star Trek news. It's really short. It's only 3 minutes for those of you who aren't really into video podcasts. And it's not just me staring at you all the time. So it keeps moving. Yeah, so give it a look.
Yeah, I've really been enjoying watching Hyper Channel. So definitely check it out, guys.
All right, Greg. Well, I really appreciate you joining me today.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a blast.
Looking forward to the next one and talking some more Star Trek. And we've actually got quite a few things that we almost hit on today that we can hit on next time.
Oh, yeah, I'm raring to talk about this again. So, yeah, good talking with you.
Until next time, everyone, for Greg Harbin, I'm Christopher Jones. This has been The Ready Room, and we'll see you out there.